Intellectual Muscle, University Dialogues for Vancouver 2010. Sport and inclusion. Are major sporting events inclusive of First Nations and other groups? Juanik Horn Miller, former Olympic athlete, activist, speaker, and television personality, shares the story of her journey and how she helps others achieve their dreams through sport. A panel discussion with Sharon and Shirley Firth and Valerie Jerome follows her presentation.
I want to introduce myself as I was raised. My name is Juanik Karakuinunta Onakaragete Sunshine Horn Miller, and I'm Bear Clan because my people are a matrilineal people, so I follow my mother's clan. But I'm also very proud of my father's side. He's from Six Nations, and he's Wolf Clan, so I'm very proud to be from those two people, and I really am thankful to be invited here today, especially to the Musqueam lands. Thank you for having me. When I was asked to speak about this particular issue, I've been asked to speak about a lot of issues all over North America to Native and non-Native audiences. But one of the things that has kind of been an untouched subject is this particular question. Is sport inclusive to Aboriginal people in this country? And I've had a very intricate experience with the elite sports system in Canada. I do have a little bit of knowledge about that. But, you know, first off, I couldn't start speaking about what I think the issues are until I tell you how I got involved with sport. My mother was a Native rights activist back in the 60s. And I always start my speech because, as we all know, you don't get there alone and you have to have someone show you the way. And I had a mother who was a single mother. She was well known for being quite outspoken and quite unique in her own right. And one of the most famous things that she actually did that ties into my life was in about 1964, the Minister of Indian Affairs had signed a deal with the City of Montreal to put a city dump from the city on my reserve. And there was a lot of uproar on my community, but they didn't stop it. So they started dumping garbage in Ganawaga, and you know what comes with garbage, right? Rats. So there was all these rats running through the houses and all kinds of stuff. And so they started complaining to the Indian agent, and my mom and all her buddies, you know, her radical buddies at the time were raising a stink. And so they finally wrote letters to Indian agent, wrote letters to the Minister of Indian Affairs to get a meeting. And at the time, the Minister of Indian Affairs was Jean Chrétien. So they're heading off to Ottawa to go get a meeting with him. And before they left, they live trapped a whole bunch of rats. And they put the rats in a big duffel bag and put it in a box and headed off to Ottawa and went to the meeting with the minister. And on one side, there was her and her. My uncle was there, too, a kind of ragtag bunch of people from Ganawaga. And then on the other side were all the suits and ties. And they're arguing back and forth. And, you know, all the aides are saying, oh, well, you know, we'll have to have a Royal Commission report written on this. And we'll do a study. And then, you know, in 10 years, we'll come back to you. So they're arguing. My uncle told me, he says, you know, I saw your mom, she's sort of leaning across the table getting madder and madder. And he said, as he saw her doing that, he bent down, and what were the pants like in the 1960s? Giant bell bottoms, right? So he started to bend down and tuck his pants into his socks. And she said to him, she says, well, if we have to live with the rats, she said this to Jean Chrétien, you have to live with the rats. They brought out the box, opened it up, and all the rats came pouring out. And she said, man, you should have seen those guys jumping on the tables. And the rats were going all over the place, running up pant legs, all kinds of stuff. Anyway, the dump was removed. Interesting enough, fast forward to right after my participation in the 2000 Olympic Games, I'm at this big event in Ottawa talking about sport and whether how we're going to improve our performance. And I get called up on stage with as the mosaic of Canadian sport. And I'm up there with all these incredible athletes that have won multiple gold medals. And I'm, well, the token Indian, right? The only Native Olympian. So I'm standing up there going, oh my God, I can't believe I'm up here with all these incredible athletes. And Jean Chrétien, who's now Prime Minister, he's going down with his aide, shaking everybody's hand and congratulating everybody. And he gets to me and he goes, how is your mother? She was a fighter. And he leans back to his aide and he goes, do you know who her mother is? She kicked my ass. And all these other Olympians are looking down at me, including Donovan Bailey, going, who are you? Anyway, I went home and told my mom that, and he said, make sure you tell your mother I said hello. And I went and told my mom, and she was just like, he remembers me. I'm like, Mom, you let rats go in his house. So there it was to say, I had a mother who wasn't afraid to make a statement, and she raised four daughters with three, I think, cardinal rules. And my mom was brought up with not a lot of parenting role models. There was a lot of issues in our community, like in a lot of communities. So she was in her 30s, which was considered old at the time to have kids. And she decided she was going to make some fundamental choices for us. And one was putting us into sports. Two was our nutrition. My mom read this book I think it was one of the very first sports nutrition books ever released. It was called Eat to Win. And it was this, and she planned our entire, I knew what I was eating a month in advance. And every meal had broccoli in it, if I remember correctly. It was one of the cardinal rules about this book. And there was no alcohol in my home. And, you know, my mom, she put us into sports at the YMCA at first. And she chose sports in particular. She chose running and swimming in particular because they were not judged sports, that we were racing against time. Because she didn't want our differentness, our, as she called it, our Indianness to get in the way. So that's why we were put into swimming and running. But one of the other reasons why my mother chose sports for me, and I was speaking about this today to kids, is I was a very hyper little girl. I probably would have been heavily medicated on Ritalin had I been a child of today. I was so hyper, and I would disrupt my class like crazy all the time. So my teacher called my mother in and said, you got to do something about this kid. She's really, really nice, but she doesn't shut up. She doesn't stop breaking things and always hurting herself. And I mean, I would get up and I would wake up like a shot at 5:30 in the morning and not stop talking or moving until I went to bed at 8 o'clock at night. How many of you guys have kids like that? Right. We all know somebody like that. Anyway, I was so hyper that my older sisters had to take me for a run around the block when I got home from school. And every lap, they would ride their bikes, and I would run the whole time and talk. And every lap, they'd ask me, are you tired? And I'd be, no, I'm not done yet. I'm not done telling my story. I was just such a hyper kid. So what my mother did is that she didn't know what to do. She knew I was getting in trouble at school. So she decided to take me home and go see my duda, my grandmother. And my grandmother and her were talking in Mohawk and discussing my problem. And my grandmother finally says, I know what's wrong with her. And loosely translated, she said, she has worms in her stomach. And my mom goes, really? She says, yeah, and the worms are making her hyper. So my mom goes, what can I do? She says, well, we'll give her Indian medicine and it'll kill the worms. And my grandmother had this big cupboard full of jars of Indian medicine, and one of the medicines that Mohawks use is dried beaver balls shaved into a tea. And I don't know if she put that in the medicine that she gave me, but she pulled down these jars and she started putting it into a bag and said, boil it in milk and give it to her three times a day. And I think one of the ingredients was wild garlic, right? And I went to a school where I was like the only kid of color in my whole school. So I had a lot of hard times making friends. And I started being force-fed this medicine. And I mean, what happens when you eat a lot of garlic? You start to sweat garlic. And the kids could smell me coming for like half a mile. You know, here comes Winique, run! You know, she stinks. Anyway, I was just, and she gave it to me for 3 months. And I swear, probably anything that was probably in my body that could have hindered my energy level was killed. I got more hyper, more crazy. My mother gets another call from my teacher. She says, your daughter is driving me crazy. Take her to the doctor. Doctor takes a look at me, checks me out, and he goes, I know what's wrong with your daughter. And my mom goes, what? She's hyper. And my mom goes, well, what do I do? He says, put her in swimming because she can't hurt herself and they won't let her drown. So that's exactly how I got into swimming, and which is a very non-traditional sport for Native people, right? I mean, you never hear of too many competitive swimmers. But I look back on my love of sport, and it was something I garnered a lot of self-confidence from at a very young age. I went to an almost all-white school, so in a lot of areas of my social life, I was ostracized, but as soon as I was, there was a team named, I was the first one named. So at a very young age, I correlated sport and self-confidence and acceptance. So I really threw myself into my sports, and I actually became pretty good. I became provincial champion in swimming, and I did a lot of track. But I had never heard of the Olympic Games. I had never even had known the concept of the Olympic Games until 1984. And 1984, one of the most momentous things happened to me. And it was when I got to see, I remember this, like clear as day. We were at a swim meet in a place called Clayton, New York, just over the border. And my mom had this, me and my two older sisters and my three stepsisters, and we were all thrown in this big Ram van, Indian van, and we headed to swim meets all over the place. And that summer, my mom had brought along this portable black and white television, and she grabbed us all and she says, "You got to sit down, you got to watch this." And so she pulls out this black and white television, plugs it into the lighter, pulls out two coat hangers, sticks them in the back, pulls out two balls of aluminum foil. And I'm looking, I'm like, "What am I looking for, Mom?" And she says, "We're trying to get the Olympic feed." "What's the Olympics?" And she says, "The Olympics is where all the best athletes in the whole world go to compete. And whoever wins is the best in the world, their Olympic champion." And I looked at her and I went, "Hey, that sounds like a great idea." It was like the first time I ever heard about it. And she says, "And you're about to watch history happen." And I'm like, "History? Try explaining to a seven-year-old what history means. It's not an easy concept." She says, "Well, there's another Mohawk that is competing to become the Olympic champion. His name is Alwyn Morris, and he's from our community." And so I remember her playing with the TV, and through the snow and everything, I see the starting line of the 1,000 meters for kayaking. And I said to her, "Well, what do we do, Mom? And well, how can we help?" And she says, "You need just pray, like send them all your good energy." And I remember the gun went off, and I think I prayed so hard I started to levitate. I was clenching my little hands. And anyway, when he crossed that finish line first, I just was so excited. And he climbed out of his boat, went to get his gold medal. And when he bent down to get his gold medal, as he stood up, he pulled out an eagle feather and he held it over his head. And I looked at my mom and I said, "He knows I'm watching him." I thought he did that just for me. Honest to God, a little seven-year-old, totally self-centered, right? And she looked at me, and I was a kid with a lot of smart comments and a lot of something to say about everything. She looks at me and she says, "So what do you think?" And I looked at her and I went with big eyes and I said, "I want to go to the Olympics. I want to be an Olympian." We often hear our kids make big comments like that, make statements like they want to go to Disneyland or they want to be an astronaut. And we often laugh and go, "Oh, that's so cute," you know. But she got down on her knee and she grabbed my shoulders and she said, "You can do it and I'm going to help you." And, you know, for both of us, I think that statement all those years ago was probably one of the most profound statements. And I know for myself, it was that Olympic dream that started that day when I was 7 years old pretty much saved my life. When you get that dream going, an Olympic dream, it was such a, I often say it was almost like my favorite teddy bear. It would put me to bed at night and wake me up in the morning to go to swim practice. And you know, I used to go home to, I mean, I lived on and off in my community. And I used to go home and my aunts and stuff would point people out in my community and say, "Oh, you know that guy over there, he was a really good hockey player. He could have been in the NHL. But, well, why didn't they?" I'd always ask that question. Why didn't they succeed? Why didn't they, if they had so much talent, what is it that stopped them? And you know what? I found out at a very young age exactly the kind of things that can stop a dream, can stop you dead in your tracks. I had no understanding because I had such a innocent concept of what the world was up until that point. And when the OCA crisis happened in my community, it was something that totally came out of left field for me. I had never experienced that level of racism or trauma in my life. You know, my community, I saw that summer, and I'm sure a lot of you remember watching it on television. It was a 78-day standoff that, you know, I never thought I'd find myself in the middle of all that. I was 14 years old, and I'll never forget my mom coming in to my room at 5:30 in the morning on July 11th, shaking me awake, saying, "They just attacked Gunasadaga. They just attacked." She dragged me out of bed, put me in front of the TV, and I was like, "What?" And it was like a war was going on in not my community, but my sister community of Gunasadaga. And in support of that barricade that actually wound up being erected in Gunasadaga. And a lot of people don't know that initial barricade in Gunasadaga, there was an initial barricade 3 months prior to July 11th. It was actually set up on a dirt road in the back pines that wasn't even really used by local traffic. And they would just sit there. Literally, it was a bunch of teenagers and some old ladies that would sit around a fire and drink tea and tell stories. For 3 months, there was a peaceful barricade. And that morning, they sent in the paramilitary provincial police to attack them. And it was an incredible thing that happened that morning, is because they shot tear gas at them. For some reason, a big gust of wind came up off the Ottawa River and blew all the tear gas back into the faces of the police. And what happened is that they ended up getting disoriented and retreating. And in that whole melee, they left all their cars and everything there. And so what did we do? We made a blockade. And we made a blockade on a provincial highway. And my community of Ganawage, we blocked the bridge that connects the South Shore to the city of Montreal. Well, I came into that situation. I followed my mother. You know, she got involved with the negotiations and stuff. I first went to Ganawage. We were living in Ottawa. Traveled home to Ganawage. And then followed my mother to Gunasadaga. And I remember the night we decided to head over to Gunasadaga, we had to go in the middle of night in a boat with no lights. And my little sister, who was 4 at the time, you know, my mom was already there and I wanted to go find her. She says, "Okay, take a boat and they'll drop you off on the shore and someone will come pick you up." So we get driven there in the middle of the night and the guy in the boat says, "Okay, get out of the boat." So I get out of the boat, I have my little sister, and I'm like 14, and I'm walking up, you know, the shore, and out of the trees come all these guys dressed in camouflage, these Mohawk warriors, and they all have their faces covered, and they go, "Who are you, and what are you doing here?" And I go, "I'm looking for my mom." And they go, "Who's your mother?" And I said, "Continental Horn." And they go, "Oh, cousin." And they take their face mask off. "Come on." And they threw me in the back of a van and they brought me to the main headquarters of where they were kind of set up. And I remember, and not many people can probably pinpoint the day they stopped being a child and became an adult. And that was that morning when I walked into that treatment center and I saw this woman that had been cooking all night and doing all these dishes. She looked exhausted. And I thought to myself, I'm 14. I could probably just keep walking by and get away with doing nothing. I could still be a kid. Or I could help her. And I thought, I'm going to help her. And from that moment on, I was in charge of cooking 2 meals a day, taking care of the kids. And I was kind of, I was actually manned some barricades because there were so few warriors. A lot of people, I remember watching the news and they were broadcasting that all these weapons that we had, and we were going, we actually counted if we had actually gotten in a firefight, we would have lasted 10 seconds with the amount of bullets we had. We had nothing. And I remember there were so few warriors to man the barricades that they actually stuck me out there on that main famous barricade one night. I said, "Well, are you going to give me a gun?" They're like, "No." So they gave me a baseball bat. So I sat there with my baseball bat all night, and I'm like, if they even peek over, we're finished. I've lost the war for everybody. Anyway, it was a very amazing experience at the very end of it. And it was September 26th that we decided to end the Oka crisis. It was something that day we decided we were going to walk out and we were going to surrender. Ganawage had already had to surrender the bridge. So we decided we were going to walk out, but in negotiations with the army, they wanted us to go out the front gates and just get onto some buses. And at that point, the media barricade had been pushed about 100 meters back. And we were afraid that if we went and walked right out the front gates and the media didn't see us, then anything could happen. Maybe someone would take a shot or something would happen and anything could happen after that. It would just be, all hell would break loose. So what we decided to do is that we decided to take a walk to the front and walk along the barbed wire. And actually, a lot of people don't know this, but we were encircled in a size of a football field, and they had used all the barbed wire in Canada to encase us. There was four levels of barbed wire surrounding us. And interestingly enough, I remember walking. As we decided to leave, I was given all the kids and all their money, and their parents gave me and said, just get the kids to safety. But as I was walking out front along the barbed wire was full of broken condoms. Because the day before, the Army had sent in a box of 60,000 Army-issue condoms. And I was receiving all this stuff as part of my job, and me and all the other young ones, what are we going to do with these 60,000 condoms? And I said, I know what we can do. Let's have a water fight. So we created a kind of like a chain, like a assembly line of water bombs all the way from the house all the way up to the front lines. And I was wearing a hoodie, like a jumper, and I put all these water bombs in my front pocket. And as I was getting ready to climb this tree, I was wearing these cut-off jean shorts, and I was getting ready to climb the tree, and one of my friends goes, holy cow, you have muscular legs. And I go, I know, I'm going to the Olympics one day. As I'm getting ready to climb this tree, in the middle of all that, I was still thinking I wanted to be an Olympic athlete, right? Anyway, I climbed up the tree, and then the Army had this spotlight that they were kind of shining across the trees and all kinds, and they had brought in a fire truck. And I was up there thinking I was totally hidden, and I was picking off the soldiers with these water bombs. And I'm a water bowl player, I have really good aim, and thinking I'm completely hidden. Next thing you know, the spotlight finds me, and I'm like, oh no. 2 seconds later, the fire hose finds me. I don't know if any of you guys have ever been hit with a fire hose. That's a lot of pressure. I hung onto that tree, and my feet were completely backwards. And I doused me for like 20 seconds, stopped. I climbed down the tree soaking wet. All my friends are like, you okay? I'm like, give me more water bombs. And I ran to another tree. Next morning, the next day, the barbed wire was full of broken condoms, and that's why. The next day when we decided to leave, and we were going out the front door, and we took a right turn, and there was this area right in the corner that was only two levels of barbed wire high. And a lot of the warriors, they had brought some spinal boards, you know, for first aid, and they put them down on the barbed wire, and people were starting to cross over. And then fights started breaking out. Soldiers were going crazy because we had broken with what they wanted us to do, and so big fights started to break up. Kids, all the other kids got scooped up, and I just wound up with my little sister. But I'll never forget my little sister. It was the most, I mean, she started to cry, but it wasn't, I know a lot of you are parents and grandparents know that there's a lot of different cries that kids can make. They can make the I'm sad cry, I'm tired cry, I'm frustrated cry, but there's one cry that I hope you never ever hear. And that's the, I think I'm going to die cry. I'm so scared. And that's what the sound she started to make. And I remember just thinking to myself, I've got to get her out of here. And there was this one soldier, and he had to have been about 18 years old. He was standing there, and it was like this weird thing. Fights are all around us. Everybody's going crazy. And he stood there, and he was frozen solid scared. And he was standing between me and getting out onto the highway. And I said to my little sister, I said, don't worry. I said, he's not going to hurt us. And I pushed him backwards. And as I walked out onto the highway, I fought my way with my little sister almost to the press barricade. And as I got to the press barricade, I recognized a Canadian major as I stepped forward, I said, I know you. I got hit in the chest really hard. And I didn't know that the order had been given to put bayonets on the ends of their weapons. I bent over, and all the wind got knocked out of me. And I'm thankful that, because when I took a step forward, I pulled my little sister behind me as I stepped forward. Had I not pulled her behind me, she probably would have gotten that right in the head. I remember standing forward, and she put her arms around me, and someone kicked my feet out from underneath me. And that picture, there was a picture of me laying on my back, screaming in absolute terror on every front page of every newspaper in Canada. I ended up getting dragged back by the back of my clothes, fighting all the way back to where everybody else, all the other Mohawks had been encircled. We got put on buses, and I didn't realize I had been stabbed until I got put on the bus, and I looked down, and I had blood all over the front of my shirt. I got to see a medical doctor about 22 hours after it happened, And he just told me, he said, you know, you're lucky to be alive. Had it been a millimeter either way, it would have gone right into your heart. And I have a really big, ugly scar right over my heart. And for a long time, I was really shy of it. And years later, playing on the Canadian water polo team, I remember I was at a tournament in Australia, and one of the Australian girls asked me if it was a breast implant scar. And I said, don't you think I would have paid for a little bigger? And she says to me, she said, and then finally I had to explain what happened. And just, these are things that I didn't want to talk about because it automatically made me different. I mean, how many people have been stabbed by a Canadian soldier? Not many. But I'll never forget when I came out of that environment and I released from military prison, and I went back to Ottawa, and I was held up in my house, and my mom asked me, well, what are you going to do? What are you going to do? What do you want to do? No one would blame you, Monique. No, you could quit water polo. You could hide out forever, and no one would blame you. I said, I don't know what I want to do. She says, but you know what? And this is just me. Here's your mom. She says, you have always had such an incredible talent as an athlete. And if you give up on your Olympic dream now, you have just given your dream over to that soldier who stabbed you. And for the rest of your life, you're going to be telling everybody you were a talented athlete, but this guy stabbed you and it stopped you in your tracks. And at that moment, I understood about trauma and how it can absolutely paralyze you from going on. But my mother sat down and she says, don't ever give anybody that power over you. Don't ever give away your power. Power over your dreams, power over your abilities. She says, I know you're scared and I know it's hard and I'm going to be there to help you, but don't give it away. You're only 14. And so she pushed me out back into the world and I went back to water polo practice. And little did I know that over the next couple years, my athletic career would become what to a lot of my fellow Mohawks who had gone through the OCA crisis, a lot of them were dealing with the state. I was suffering. I didn't even know I was suffering from it, but I was suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. And a lot of my community members and a lot of the most famous Mohawks that were in that crisis are dead. If it's not from suicide, it was from drug and alcohol abuse. They were self-medicating to get through it. I self-medicated through sports. I became obsessed with sports. You couldn't keep me away from a water polo practice. It was that passion and that sudden need to be in the pool that probably catapulted my career into high gear. And I made the national team when I was 18 years old. And I went on to make the senior team a year later. And interestingly enough, 10 years after, exactly to the day that I got stabbed, I was at the Olympics, the exact day. And I remember my first game. My first game was against the Russians. I called my mom the night before, and I said, Mama, how's everything? And she goes, how are you going to see us in the stands? There's like 10,000 people in the stands. And my mom's she started to get all freaked out. And my little sister grabs the phone from my mom. She says, don't worry, I got it covered. And I was like, oh, no. I come marching out next day, and we're getting introduced to the fans. I'm looking up in the stands, and my eyes come to rest on my little sister, and she had dyed her hair fire engine red and stuck it straight up. She looked like a pom-pom or a firework or something. Face is all painted. She's going crazy. Woo! I didn't miss her. And my mom, who I thought would be right next to her, dressed up some crazy way, she was standing there. And my mom has these beautiful green eyes, and she was just crying, tears. I could see them glistening. From as far away as I was, I could see that she was crying. And that first thing I thought was, someone was mean to my mom. What did they do? I didn't know. I didn't know what to think. So I got in. Okay, I got to play my game. Scored 2 goals. Ended up tying the Russians. Got out, did all the media stuff. Ran up to see my mom. I grabbed her, and my mom by then was all, she was all happy and so proud of me. And I said, Mom, why were you crying? And she says, you know what? She said, when I saw you walk out for your first game in the Olympics, it finally totally dawned on me that you had achieved your dream. And she says that it made me think of all those years ago, 17 years ago, that you told me you wanted to be an Olympian. and I made you that promise, I'll help you. And I started thinking of all those hard times when we had no money, when we were in an OCA crisis, when she was on trial with three different criminal trials because of it. And there were many times she didn't think she was going to be able to keep her promise. And she said, when you walked out, she says, I was proud of myself as a mother. And I was crying because I was proud. And I was like, I mean, I've made her cry many times because she's mad. But when she, to make her cry, to make a parent cry because she's proud of herself, I think was the crowning moment of my Olympic career. I didn't win a medal. I played to the maximum capacity that I could ever possibly have played, and I didn't win a medal. But I think what I accomplished, and looking back, and I mean, I often say this to people, when you see those Olympians on the podium and they're crying, yeah, they're happy about the moment, but what they're crying about often is what everything they've gone through to get there. All the barriers that they didn't think they could overcome, they were able to overcome. And, you know, it's something now that I get asked to travel and speak in many communities. And I don't consider myself anything special, but I feel a very strong passion for the next generation. The fact that I was the only Aboriginal person from North America to actually participate in 2000, these Olympic Games are quite monumental because there were actually three women that competed for Canada and the United States. But this doesn't reflect the talent that exists in our communities. And a lot of people ask me this question. In these games, it was really highlighted. You saw an amazing expression of who we are as Aboriginal people for the four host First Nations participation, which I think is a great first step. But what's the next step? And the question I often throw to the Canadian population is, take a good look at the Olympic team and notice how multicultural it isn't. Walk down any street in a major city in Canada and notice how multicultural we are and growing. I just think that never made sense to me. I think one of the things that we have to decide is that sport in our country is not just a social issue, that it's a political issue. And we need to go from being a hockey nation to a sporting nation. And I know in my community, I've been fighting this battle for many, many years to get our leadership to understand the value of sport. Not only, I tell them, it saved my life. In our communities, it's a suicide preventer. It's a leadership builder. It's a community capacity building tool. You can't put a price value on it. Well, is it all, and they ask me, well, is it all about producing more Olympians? No. If you have more people in a country doing sports at the grassroots level, more cream will rise to the top. You'll have more Olympians as a natural byproduct of more people doing it. And in our community, in the Aboriginal community, it takes on a more dire issue. As a Canadian public, the Aboriginal population in this country is the fastest growing population. In the next 30 to 50 years, five provinces and territories will be majority Aboriginal. And we have to take a look at what we need to produce a population that is a viable and contributing population that is positive and healthy and strong. And producing more Olympians, producing more doctors, producing more premiers. We have that capacity, but it has to start as an investment. And it's an investment in this country to invest in our sports and making sport more accessible to everybody. And I know it's not just an issue for Aboriginal people. You go to a lot of inner cities in this country and kids can't afford to do sports. They can't. It costs $3,000, $4,000, or $5,000. My mom went and got a job specifically with the government so she could afford to put us in sports. She said at the end of all our careers, she probably invested over $100,000 of her own money in our sports. And I said to her, but what if I had never made it to the Olympics? Would it? She's absolutely not. My oldest sister is a medical doctor. My other sister has a PhD in anthropology, sociology. I'm an Olympian. And my little sister is a Gemini-nominated actress. And we all did sports. And it's something that I cannot put a price on. We're talking about barriers. And we're talking not just about sport as an Aboriginal issue, but as an issue that impacts our entire country. And I hope it's something from these Olympic Games, the passion that's been garnered out of these games, will go back to our communities and we'll invest. And you know what? The Aboriginal world We need to work with our non-Aboriginal brothers and sisters out there to make it a possibility. And I say brothers and sisters because I strongly believe that, because I had a team, 13 of us, and they were all my brothers and sisters, and I was the only Aboriginal person on that team. And I still, to this day, consider them like family. And that's what this country has to see. We are a big family that we need to provide more opportunities. And I'm ready and raring. Now, we have a wonderful new national chief, Sean Atleo. I don't know if you guys know this, but started the first all-Native professional soccer team in BC. Your provincial chief, Jody Wilson-Raybould. She was a competitive swimmer for over 10 years. Swam university, varsity swimming. They come from sport backgrounds. So this shows the talent and the leadership that come out of people with sport backgrounds. So I want to thank you for listening to me to talk today and all my crazy stories, and thank you very much.
We're going to have a discussion about some of the things that Wanique raised, and we were able to hear some of the stories of Wanique's life journey. So it leads me to ask, and to start with you, Valerie, what got you involved in competitive athletics? What was the impetus?
Well, my older brother, whom I'm sure you've all heard of, was an outstanding athlete, world record holder. He was always very involved in sports. He played a lot of soccer, and baseball was his passion. And up until grade 10, baseball was where Harry's life was going. I know you're a big baseball fan.
Absolutely.
But anyway, he was a pitcher, and he could also bunt and get to first base. But he found the racism in baseball really depressing. And even his own team members were some of the people who heckled him when he was on the mound. And his baseball coach, Finn Burdett, said, you know, Harry, you've really got to find another sport, because obviously, you're really rattled and upset to such a degree that sometimes it makes you, you know, balk with the ball on the pitcher's mound. And it just so happened that when Harry was going into grade 11, and everybody knew he could run fast already because he could always get to first on any bunt, but I don't think they realized how fast he was. So anyway, when he was in grade 11, a member of our high school, I wasn't at North End High, but he was at North End High, had said that, yeah, Harry thought he was fast, but he wasn't that fast, and he was going to take Harry on. Well, it so happened that Harry did join the track team just because of the provocation that he had from dear Don Basham, and he whipped his butt, and so he joined the team, and I was in junior high at the time, and I actually had joined the track team at Sutherland the year before Harry had got involved. Anyway, we really loved track. We found that, in fact, there was a track club over in Vancouver that had recently been formed, and somebody was going to give us a ride there. And I must say, we really found our bliss. We were no longer judged by our North Vancouver community, where just a few years earlier, when we'd first moved to North Van, we were stoned off the school grounds the first day. We were literally camped in our backyard for the 3 days or 4 days until my dad came home from his railway trip and literally dragged us over to back onto the school grounds. The principal and the teachers at the school had seen what had happened to us, but they didn't cross the road and bring us to the school. So school was not a great place. I was really terrified of people. And somehow we got to track. And people didn't judge you by your color, or anything. It was the stopwatch. It was the measuring tape. I could long jump and high jump as well. And it was just remarkable to be freed of all those things that keep you a small person. I mean, we obviously were very physical people and we really enjoyed the activity. I can't say that my dad was away a lot on the trains. I can't say that I ever remember my parents coming to see me participate as an athlete. And I did leave home when I was quite young. When Harry went off to the University of Oregon on a scholarship, our home was not a happy one. And shortly thereafter, I actually left and moved to a foster home. And my foster parents were, in fact, Harry Cannon was the president of our track club. So, I mean, I just found my way into a world that just transformed my life. So track brought so much into my life in terms of my living conditions and my acceptance at school. I mean, after winning the Canadian Championships at age 15, I went back to school in September, and I gave up washing dishes in the cafeteria because I didn't have to hide out in the cafeteria all the time at lunchtime, avoiding people. It was amazing. So I must say the sports that actually are non-subjective. You know, there's never going to be equal opportunity, but at least you get equal assessment with a stopwatch. Yeah. The assessors are not the people in your community. The assessors are those very precise instruments which allow our society to actually judge you for who you are and what you can do. And it's the inverse of our Canadian culture, our the world culture, which is a very unfair world. Mm-hmm. And it turns things around, and it makes the world, that experience in the world, a very fair experience. That's why we need sport. It frees people from the unfairness of the world. And some sports, at least my great sport, is remarkably precise in its assessment of you. You know, it's great.
Oh, I hear you. And I've been watching the First Sisters as you talked, nodding. Now, I know that, of course, cross-country skiing in Northwest Territories has got to be an absolute dream. I'm sure all Canadians should experience that. But what got you involved? What was the element that got you both involved in athletics?
I was the one that got into skiing first. I had a friend who invited me to ski, so I had this great opportunity to be where I am today. And I couldn't go out to Dorntal unless Sharon came with me. I'm really happy that she came with me because she has all the brains and kindness and helps so many people. I remember my first day at the ski lodge. It was a Catholic event because all the kids from the Catholic school had this opportunity to ski. And Sharon and I, we were scared to go there because they might beat us up. Our trainer said, you know, if you can ski and train really well and win some races, that you can be on this team. But we had these big, thick army skis, and we didn't know how to ski whatsoever. And I said, okay, I'm going to get my first brand new pair of skis. So I went on these army skis, and I went in my first race. I was dead last. And I said, that's the last, I'm going to be last. So I trained really hard, and then the next race I won and never looked back after that. But I think it was really important that if you notice that our young ones who are talented, get them into sports, and they can excel.
Do you take turns winning?
Well, winning wasn't really part of sports for me. It was just out there having fun with my friends. But prior to getting into cross-country skiing,
so joining sports was really, it was a real stepping stone into, I got the Order of Canada, you know, and something that I would never ever dream of was going to the Olympics, never ever heard of it in my life. Growing up in Inuvik, kids always got picked to go on different events, and our family, our other family, because we're all other, we were never picked, you know, and I often thought, like, what's the matter with us? What's wrong with our family? But it wasn't that. It was because it was not that we were overlooked. I think Shirley and I were very talented, and sometimes when you have that talent, people are afraid of you. Mm-hmm. So When we got introduced to cross-country skiing, I mean, man, that really changed our life. You know, sports was really fun. Meeting people earthwide was really fun. I'm so sorry we didn't win gold medals for you. But through our sport, it really, you know, our coach really taught us to believe in our dreams. And at a very young age, I started setting goals for myself. I was 4 years old. I didn't know where that dream came from, but I knew that when I when I stepped into the real world, because I was no longer other. I knew who I was, and having that strong background and being proud of who I was as a Native person, you know, I always felt that maybe we might help other people out there. And sports was not always, like it wasn't always to win out there, but Shirley and I trained, we're pioneers, we really set the mark for cross-country skiing in Canada. And when we graduated from grade 12, you know what a, that was so huge graduating. We had to move away from the Northwest Territories, and that was really hard. You know, we moved to Banff, which was, that's a resort. You know, that's just for rich people, that's for famous people, not us. But we were really shy, Shirley and I, you know, and when we got to Banff, we had to look for a place to stay. And this wonderful, absolutely wonderful family, the Robinsons, called Shirley and I up and invited us to stay with them. They didn't even know who we were, you know. And on top of that, we were Indian. So out of their kindness, we refused to stay with them because we had to make it on our own as Indian people. Doesn't that sound nice? You know, as Indian people, we have to prove ourselves every day. From the time you wake up to the time you go to bed, we have to prove ourselves. I mean, that's just the way it is, you know. So Shirley and I went pounding on doors looking for a place to stay. Sometimes people open their door and just slam it and, you know, okay, that's okay. Because we weren't raised with this prejudice. We didn't know what that was. Because we were raised with the Inuit people, very strong, powerful people. We were raised with our own people, and plus it was very multicultural where we came from. So we didn't know what racism was. So when people talk about that, it's really foreign to us because we were raised to get along with everyone. Isn't that wonderful? Yeah. But at the end of the day, it was sports that really, really made us who we are.
Very interesting. Now, Wanik, you mentioned the idea that part of the problem in terms of inclusion is socioeconomic, that a lot of sports are expensive. During the day we talked about this as well. Can you give us a reading in terms of your experience? How much of it is that, you know, social economic issues, hockey, you know, particularly for your goaltender, very expensive, versus abject prejudice? Can you
One of the things that when I was an athlete, like from a very young age, there was a lot of stereotypes. At a very young age, Aboriginal people learn that everything you do is political. Everything you do represents your entire people. And for instance, if they walk down the street and see a homeless or an Aboriginal person who's got a drug and alcohol problem, they don't just say that poor guy, they say those poor people. And, you know, I realized that, you know, at a young age, even as a competitive swimmer and competitive runner, I had actually parents and coaches saying stuff to me, really young. And even when I got invited to the senior national training camp, the first conversation, real conversation I had with my coach was I walked onto deck and he yelled across the pool. He's like, "Hey you, hey Winnie, come over here." And I'm like, thought I was in the wrong place. I got the wrong letter, you know. I should have got the rejection letter. So I walk over and I go, "Yeah." And he goes, "You're Native, eh?" And I mean, as we all know, that's not what you want to start a conversation with. That always ends bad. It used to end bad for me when I was a kid. And I go, "Yeah, I'm Mohawk." And he goes, "And the second thing you never want to hear is, I heard some things about your people." And that's what he said. I heard some things about your people. And I'm like, I'm like, "Oh, really? What did you hear?" And he said, "Well, I hear that your people are kind of lazy. You know, they're really talented, but they're lazy. And I heard that they're uncoachable because they just don't like to listen to authority. And I heard that they're, you know, kind of slow. And, you know, water polo has a lot of tactics and, you know, you have to be kind of smart to play." And saying all this stuff. And you know what? One side of me, I had heard that my whole life throughout my career. All these things, that these stereotypes about my people. And I mean, you hear it enough. I was always worried that it might be true, that somehow that a switch would flick inside of me and I would just want to quit and I'd be really lazy, right? But the other side of me, the Mohawk side of me, got really angry. And so I looked at him and I said, oh yeah? And he goes, whoa, wait a second. Why don't you just get in the water and show me what you can do? But right from that discussion of the very day one of my experience on the national team was knew that I wasn't on even playing field with my non-native teammates. They didn't have to prove themselves, their whole race is, equality. And, I went home angry. I was mad, and I told my mom that. She goes, well, you knew it was going to be like that. It's going to be like that until there's hundreds and hundreds of us, thousands and thousands of us in elite sport. But because you're the first, you are going to have to disprove every little thing. And you know what? It forced me to actually push myself. And I knew I had to be 150% better. And so I pushed myself further and further. And actually, it was interesting because we would swim for 2 hours in the morning, then go do an hour of weights, and then my teammates would all head off home, and I would cross to the indoor track and just run, and I'd usually run for an extra hour. And there was an athlete, Bruni Surin, who's on the 96 gold medal relay team. And man, those sprinters have the life, eh? He'd lie there on his massage table and get massaged, do one sprint through these little markers. And it was because it's about form, right? It's like form and technique, sprinting. And I'm chugging around the track, hauling it. And he said to me, he says, why are you, come here after a couple weeks of watching me do this. He says, why are you doing this? And I said, because I have to be better. And it was partly to disprove all those people, but to show myself that I had to be better. And when I made the Olympics, and one of the first people I saw in the Olympics Village was Bruni Surin, and he gave me the biggest hug. He says, see, you're better. You made it. But it is out there. Racism, discrimination is out there. And it's because, is it a conscious thing? I think it's because often this country, one of the biggest disservices we do to the population is through education. You don't teach the real history. And I mean, people have such little access to our people. That's why having the four host First Nations open themselves and show the world who we are was such a huge step, because it was probably the first time ever the average Canadian felt comfortable enough to just come and experience our culture and get a positive, And it's funny because in the mainstream media, Aboriginal issues are kind of they always report on the bad stuff, eh? We're like the traffic accident on the side of the highway that people can't help but slow down and stare at, but don't want to know if anybody's really hurt. That's Aboriginal issues in Canada. And one of the greatest things about these Olympic Games, it showed the beautiful, amazing side of our culture that we have to contribute. It's the first step. But as far as having our people in the Olympic Games, and if you just let me say, I have four things that I can say that are the barriers. Economics, location. In this country, if you are going to get into elite sports, you generally have to be, if you're not in a program like cross-country skiing, you have to be in an urban setting. Our people, 50% are living on reserves, but that's a large population, living in isolated areas. Economics, also the culture of sport, and in my experience being on the national team, is that the culture that kind of runs sport in this country is so far behind what the culture of many other areas of our society. For instance, in any workplace, none of you would ever, ever accept to be treated the way in which athletes have to accept that they're treated by many of their coaches. And I ran into this in my sport, where the attitude from a lot of coaches were, you break down the athlete and then you build them up again. I'm going to make you and break. And they're the way they talk to you. Well, my mother raised me, well, you're born with all the gifts that you have, and it's my job as a parent and the job of a coach to help cultivate that out of you. She says, you should never leave your sport feeling broken. You should feel stronger. The culture of sport in Canada is I would say that of what is it was acceptable in the mid-50s. And the whole concept of power, I would talk to a lot of my non-athletic friends, and they said, you let this coach talk to you like that? And my coach, it was not unheard of for him to, I remember one of my teammates, he, in a game, she was a rookie, and we were in a tournament in Holland, and he said to her, "You're so stupid, I'm going to cut your head off and send it home to your dad, and he'll understand because you're the stupidest person I've ever met." How are you going to get someone to play well? You know? So it's the culture of sport. And I walked into a culture of sport where my first instinct was, and I was raised that I deserve to be treated with respect because I'm a human being and you need to work with me to get the best out of me. And I realized very soon it was a top-down approach, and you do not go outside of that chain of command. And I learned that. And I would say the final thing, and especially for Aboriginal people, is there's a lot of issues surrounding which are historical, and I would call them intergenerational re-traumatization. And it happens quite a bit, like in my friends, my Jewish friends whom I speak to with the Holocaust. It's this not wanting to forget what happened to our ancestors and all the struggles that they went through to get where we are today. But it's almost like you're passing on trauma. And an example I've used is my mother. I remember coming home from a water polo practice one day, and my mom, she had been reading some historical book, and she goes, "Did you know that in the Ohio Valley, 100,000 Iroquois warriors were massacred?" And it was like she just watched it on CNN. And I was like, "Oh, okay, thanks, Mom." I didn't know what to do with it. And I was like, "Thanks for the boulder. I'm going to throw it on the rest of them that I'm dragging behind me." That night, I didn't know what to do with it. I remember lying in bed going, I never want to forget what my ancestors went through. I want to honor them. I don't want to forget, because if you forget, then maybe they'll disappear out of your memory. But then I started thinking, I have to change this because it's just going to kill me to have to deal with all that all the time. And I remember thinking to myself as I laid there, I said, "Okay, be practical, Winique." And I started thinking, okay, well, someone had to survive or I wouldn't be here. So then I started thinking about, okay, what's that one warrior? One warrior survived, okay? And I started thinking to myself, man, he must have been awesome. And he must have been so strong and so creative and never given up and so smart. All the things that for my whole life I've been told my people are, he couldn't have been all those things. Because if he had been lazy and dropped his war club, he would have gotten massacred. And so, in a way, I started thinking, my people have been put into an environment of natural selection. That if you were lazy, if you were weak with disease and war and famine, if you were any of those things, you died off. And I thought to myself, I'm descendant from the best of the best of my people. And I started thinking, I'm like, wow, that is powerful. And then I thought, why did he not stop fighting? Why did he never let down his war club? It's because he was thinking of me, and he wanted, seven generations down, he wanted me to thrive, and he wanted me to go after my dreams. And would he want me to cry about what he went through all those years ago? Absolutely not. He'd want me to go out and honor his sacrifice with me being the best I could be. So I had to create my own sort of sports psychology. And I had to do that. And it was really hard, but that's what I had to do with that whole experience.
Oh, very interesting. Valerie, I just read that you had an experience when you were part of the torch relay that went through Canada, and you reflected on what the composition of the Olympic team was that you were on.
Yeah, it was interesting. I was a member of the 1960 Olympic team, and in those games, a man named Abibi Bikila from Ethiopia won the marathon. He actually won it in the next Olympics after that in 64. The 56 Olympics, we got to see a film at this reunion before we ran the torch, and it was a very white Olympics, and it was what the Summer Olympics had been like for a very long, long time. My grandfather had run in the 1912 Olympics for Canada. This is my mother's father. He was a black man from the United States, and he ran in Winnipeg, and he beat every American he ran against. I've seen all these newspaper clippings. And yet when he mustered with the Canadian team mustered in Montreal before they set off for Stockholm, Sweden, he wasn't even allowed to stay in the same hotel as the other athletes. He was ridiculed. There were quotes in the press that this uppity boy, he was 22 and a half years old at the time, had the courage, or he was stupid enough to think that he was going to win these Olympics. He was the joke of the team. They nicknamed him Smoke on board the ship. Anyway, he didn't eat for whatever reason. I can't say he was banned from the dining room, but he was not in the dining room in Stockholm, and he was cooking for himself. He did become very ill. He did not finish his... He ran the semis and he ran heats, but he did not finish the final. I gather he had stomach problems, and I would assume it might have been caused by the food that maybe he was keeping in his room. Anyway, all those years later, in 1960, my brother Harry and I became Canadian champions. And Harry was constantly referred to in the media as being uppity. And when you refer, Monique, to the fact that they somehow want to keep you down, it wasn't our coach who was keeping us down, but Harry was always referred to as uppity. The members of the Canadian delegation who were in charge of us as athletes in Rome were actually betting with each other as to whether Harry, who had set a world record just prior to our going to Rome, they were betting that he would quit or he would fold or that he wasn't good enough. And sure enough, when he became injured in the semifinals, they were proved right. This, you know, uppity boy, the reception that Harry and my grandfather had on the teams were because, of course, of their race. We hadn't had very many black participants. I know that in 1938 there was a black man who ran in the Commonwealth Games for Canada and won the 800 meters. But when we went to the Olympic trials in Saskatoon in 1960, and Harry set this world record, we were the only black people at the meet. We really were the odd people out. And the media worked very hard to all of our comments in the press. I've unfortunately got all these bad news stories. I should burn them. I'm giving them to SFU. Anyway, you know, we were always called the dusky pair, the dusky duo. Our race was mentioned continually. And the really good sports writers here in Vancouver, Dick Beddoes and Eric Whitehead, when they wrote about Harry, they didn't even mention his race. They wrote about his achievements, the number of races he just won. Some of these people, that's all they could talk about was our race. And that Harry was far too uppity. I wasn't. I was terrified of everybody. I know you don't believe that. But
I don't believe that.
It was the whole notion of sort of, I really felt for that comment of the psychology. It wasn't as for us, the coach is doing it. But, you know, if you want to be really great, if your country really believes in you, hopefully they'd want to build you up. You know, things have changed. In the 1980s, I was walking down Georgia Street, looked in the Hudson Bay window, and they had all these television sets on. And the final of the men's 100 meters at the Canadian Championships, every single person getting into the blocks was black. And although I knew that at one level, and although I'd been following the sport and I was working as an official, it just astounded me that the whole line was black. And so in our sport, there really isn't the exclusion by race. Track and field in Canada is very much a black sport. But I must say, I do feel there are lots and lots of barriers to the other sports in this country for people of color.
Well, I was going to ask you that because to some degree, there was a bit of a turning point in the Winter Olympics here when those of us who were watching the bobsled races out of Whistler, the two-man women's team that won the silver, Shelly-Ann Brown. And then, of course, in the four-man team that won the bronze, Lascelles Brown, who's a black Canadian, originally, I think, from Jamaica, and he took bronze, was part of the team. So is this space and time, or are we getting somewhere here?
Gosh, I'm not always the most optimistic person, so, you know, you have to take that with a bit of thought. I guess, yes, actually, it is. It is a step forward. Well, the inclusion of anybody in any area, it is a step forward. And I'm sure, just as hockey eventually might have a few more... I mean, there have been some phenomenal hockey players in this country who've been of color and have never played in the NHL. And, you know, things are changing. It was interesting, though, that there were people who did come from other countries. There was an Iranian woman who skied. There was an athlete from Ethiopia in skiing and somebody else from Ghana. I noticed the province newspaper actually printed an article saying, my God, let's not deal with these other people coming in. They're not going to be winners. They're taking the attention away from the real stars. I didn't think the real stars suffered from any lack of coverage, certainly not in the newspapers. I thought they were very well covered. But the notion that we should keep out these people from these small, non-snowy, non-white countries, to me seemed, there's an element there that people don't really necessarily want to be inclusive. But yes, obviously there are.
Do you think the same? Like in your sports or in the Winter Games, for example, are we becoming more inclusive?
Well, coming from the Northwest Territories, I think that we're growing. We're having more and more of our people who are included in sport, and then it stops. So what's going on? You know, is it because they don't have the money to do it? Is it because the parents are not available? And especially women, why can't we have more women in sport?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a really good question. I know when I went to my first Olympics in Sapporo, Japan, a long time ago, 1972, there was six of us from the Northwest Territories that were Aboriginal that made the Olympic team. And I would look around at our team to see if there's any other Native people out there, and no. 1976, I didn't see any Native people either. 1980, none. 1984, none. But apparently there were Native people out there, but for them to identify themselves, you know, that's a lot of pressure. I wish they did, because I think more Native people would step up to the plate and, you know, not be afraid of who they are, because, you know, we were all made. There's many races out there, right? You know, like there's many tribes, there's many nations. So God made all these people. So we should be included.
Absolutely. Wani, do you know anything about how the Australians, we know how they encouraged, I guess, the podium. We have many more Australian victories now in Olympic Games. But what about the Aboriginal people? How did Kathy Freeman succeed? In light of, you know, what was a country that really looked down on, again, their native people?
Well, I mean, I think it's part of the bigger picture, and I go back to the 1976 Olympics, where the Australian Olympic team only won, like, I think about six medals, and the country was in an uproar about that, and they actually had a referendum, a political referendum, to increase their funding to sport in 1976, and they only really saw that come to fruition, that investment come to fruition really on the podium in 2000 at their Olympic Games. And part of that was their Aboriginal Talent Identification Program. They do talent identification in Australia through their Australian Institute of Sport. And they have identified four sports where they do specific talent identification in the Aboriginal community. That's boxing, track and field, field hockey, and rugby. And in my Olympic Games in 2000, there were 15 Aboriginal people on the Australian team. And I think there was five medals, and three of those were gold. And it wasn't because there was a spot saved for an Aboriginal person. It's because they won those spots. And they went out to the communities and did talent identification. And from my understanding now, they're expanding. They wanted to perfect that. And what the most interesting thing is, they looked at the historical, social, cultural and economic issues surrounding Aboriginal excellence and performance. And they brought in the academics, they brought in, and they looked at all the issues, and they tried to develop a program that would support the success of the Aboriginal community. And they didn't try to take the Aboriginal people and stick them into the mainstream. They didn't try to take that. They actually developed a specific program for Aboriginal communities. And it was something that was very successful, and now they're developing centers of excellence in the Aboriginal communities. And I'm so jealous.
So is that a good model, you think, for us?
I think it's a model that, because of the nature of our location, we are in a segregated, still society where we are on reserves. We have to think about those issues and bring them to the table when we're developing it. And I think in order for us to have success, we do have a budding success story in the First Nation snowboard team that is a specific program. But we need to have a researched, strategic approach to identify, support, and cultivate our athletes to the elite level. However, I believe strongly, even more strongly, in the fact that our communities in general, our Aboriginal communities, we need to actually create communities that are healthier, more fit, and the natural byproduct of those communities would be more Olympians. But you have to have two distinct objectives and work on those. But it needs to be a national strategic plan, and we need to actually make it a political issue for our people. I don't believe in just saying that the leadership has to do it. We actually have to get out and do it. My mother, we were her guinea pigs. She researched how she was going to do it for us. Education and sport were the two things she said, that's what you're doing. And I'm thankful she did that for me.
But speaking of the Aboriginal First Nations snowboard team, guess what? We actually have in the audience the founder and the manager of the Aboriginal snowboard team, Aaron Marchant. Aaron, please come forward. How did you get this idea?
I was working with the 2010 Bid Commission, and we were hosting these fancy meetings for the IOC in 1998, 99, 2000. 2001, it was going to start to become a reality. We were going for the bid. And coordinating the meetings, I asked Steve Poborski, how tangibly today will we benefit? We know we're going to gain some acreage in the Whistler Sea Sky Corridor. We know we're going to develop a culture center. But really, how are our youth going to benefit today? So I asked him, what can we do? Because a friend of mine who's Korean, his dad was a coach, and he's sort of my personal mentor who's mentored me through this whole experience. He said, I'll give you equipment. And so we started a PowerPoint, a budget. We needed $34,000 for 10 kids in year one. Actually, we need a lot more, about 50 or 60 for 10 kids. Well, the resorts and communities, they want to become involved with the First Nations. We need to create and strengthen communities as more resorts and more First Nations are working together. So without having to go out to the resorts with Cypress Mountain saying, when can we come down and meet you? We heard about what you want to do. Steve Poborski introducing and saying, there's this guy named Todd Allison who developed many programs for Sport Canada. I'd like you to meet him. I went up to meet Todd. Todd said, use our templates, and we adjusted them. You must do well in school, and you must commit. And with that, we're going to shoot for the podium, and we're going to certify kids to teach younger kids. To date, we have over 34 certified instructors, level one, level two. We're certified to certify. Other nations like the concept, and from reserves to resorts, our people were very wealthy. So let's take them to the top of the mountains, remind them how we once lived, where we once lived as a place of gathering power and a connection to the earth, and educate them that way from a young child. Because coincidentally, there's also going to be a labor shortage at the resorts. A lot of our communities are neighbors to the resorts. Mm-hmm. Now, if a child goes to the resort and wants to work at the resort the first time off the reserve when they're 19, that's not going to be very comfortable. But a little bit of skiing and snowboarding when they grow up. And as a result with this concept and through many partnerships and many great people, I was the founder, but there has been many great people with the games who all want to support and help as one community and one team. We hope to expand with the BC Snowboard Association and not segregate ourselves anymore. Let's go mainstream. In year one, you can see our 10 kids in the corner. This year at Big White Ski Resort, when some of our kids were on the podium and some of the girls had made it, they're on the podium, first, second, and third, and they had accomplished going to post-secondary, have accomplished so much. We couldn't even tell where our team members were. They were no longer this group in the corner. And for us, when parents are saying, thank you for this program from Little Shuswap or Chase, my son is now a straight-A student, or a young man who, when we met him, was living out of a backpack, opened a business and has expanded his business, and his problem is what his next car is he's going to buy. And watching this growth and walking away knowing that we have really changed lives, but not just us, from the Aboriginal Youth Sport Legacy Fund because of the games and because of Steve Poborski, but because the resorts want to help our communities grow. They know that we're going to have to work together, whether it be somewhere down the road and it has to do with other initiatives in the area. It's great to have a support system or a mechanism for youth to develop into role models and become educated. They have to become educated. They won't be on our team. And we coordinate with our education departments, and we share this model to each nation wherever there's a resort. which is across Canada. We have put 4 athletes on the BC team. We've had athletes go to the nationals. It's tangible. It's beyond tangible. Now that we see the 6 and 7-year-olds who are never going to know, they're going to have snowboarding their whole life. They're going to grow up in the resorts. They're going to go to the places their ancestors went to. They're going to know that all the land that they're looking at was traditionally theirs. They're a wealthy people. They're not going to feel this big. They're going to think, why don't we build our own resort and grow up with that positive? And when we bring in great life skills coaches who are going to teach them how to manage time, commitment, school, family, significant other. I'm not an athlete. I'm not a coach. I'm an executive director, and I work with our partners. But when we have a number of people who come in, like ambassadors like Winique and the First Sisters, it was nice to see them last night and today because they actually came and spoke to our athletes and brought about 100 pounds of medals. And we're going up. And our athletes see this, and they say, they can do it, we can do it. Caroline Calvey, who competed in giant slalom, she did it. Sandy Ward wants to do it. Jonathan Redman wants to do it. Triana DeLorme, who goes to UBC in the north, she just won a scholarship. She had the room captivated in a speech she did at the RBC banquet. Triana, her goal is BC team, and she's doing it in post-secondary. We're losing a lot of our senior team members to post-secondary. They can either transfer to another area. We'll shoot for the podium, but in our eyes, I think we're just building our capacity because some nations are very rural where there is no recreation department. And so we can go in and find one person who is going to learn how to be our contact and to be their communications. Because the resort's partners support our development of our program. And for Sun Peak Ski Resort to be featured number one in Ski Canada for establishing relationships a long way from 6 or 8 years ago. There's no reason why all across Canada, wherever there's a resort, the local First Nations should be sending their youth up to grow up there and building the community together. Because I don't think Canada can go wrong with investing into sport, youth. And it also makes very good business sense. Because you send one child up, the parents are going to get involved, the younger brother and sister. Everybody's going to buy lunch. And we teach them to go to the deli section. They used to go to the fries and that. And when you see this, and when you see our athletes get up, they're all very physically fit.
This is a force. This is a force.
I want to go into rooms with you, Aaron. You're going to bring it home. You're going to bring it home. But the choice of snowboard, that's interesting too, isn't it? Because that's the future. That's why I'm sure so many young people, with due respect to cross-country skiing and water polo and track, watch the Winter Games. You know, some of these new sports that really turn on young people. What do you think?
I think snowboarding is a natural fit because it's up in the mountains for us. Right. For me, it really hits home because my grandpa's name, ancestral name, was Kayasmakwa, which meant live amongst the grizzly bears. For the past 100 years, there's been no reason for our youth to go up to the mountains unless they're really involved in our culture. Right. What we're doing is just a natural, yeah. It's just a natural cycle of what we want. There's an old practice of going up there. And an elder up north from the Wet'suwet'en tribe, he said when he was a little boy, they would spend all day sliding on these trays, be outside sliding. And he was wearing sunglasses and hat, and he was about 82 years old. He says, now today, kids come home, they play video games, they have a high type 2 diabetes. He goes, I like what you're doing. You're teaching them how to slide again. And it's really just being active, not only snowboarding, they have to go through core training, yoga, sport conditioning, all summer. We now have a group of youth who have to attend 90% of what we tell them they have to. That is setting up community meetings. That is serving your elders. That is hearing what's going on with your community initiatives, going to the cultural language classes, tree planting. Every nation, every area will do it a little bit differently, but it works. And this year, when we seen 32 of our athletes carry the torch, 20 in Lillooet, it was, we had done it. We had, for us, our coordinator with the West Bank First Nation, Wes, I seen him, he's 240 pounds, he was tearing up because he knows he had done it. And I couldn't look at him when they played the music as well, because we knew that we had done it. And to see all these other parents who had come from across the country, because some of the kids have moved from across the country because it's only here in BC. But as more partnerships and community building happens within our communities and we continue to evolve together, it makes sense wherever there's a resort, we can do this program.
Aaron, thanks so much. What a great movie. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
In 1979, Shirley and I were at our Olympic trials in Mount St. Anne, and just a couple of days, a day before our races started, we got news that my mother and two nieces had died in the fire, and Shirley was actually the one that called me and told me that, and I totally freaked out inside. And you know, and I was just thinking about Joni Rochette's, you know, her, what happened to her. But with Shirley and I, we really bonded. I mean, we are twins, but we totally, totally bonded. And we didn't get the support that Joni received, you know, like her. We were very alone. Everybody back home wanted us to come back for the funeral, but we decided that, you know, my mother would be more happy if we stuck to our goals and, you know, did our best. And despite the emotional trauma we were going through, my coach told me that, oh, in 3 weeks you're going to get over it, you know. And it was very painful, but, you know, in life you... everything my mother taught us, you know, came together. And Shirley and I, we'd be out there training and, you know, we talk to one another, and sometimes you don't have to say words, you can just feel the strength we had between one another. But our team never offered us, you know, they didn't know how to react to us because we were in our own little world. But I think it really taught them that you don't mess with us. You know, we gained so much respect. And the reason I'm talking this is because when we were in the back talking about the different things, and I never realized the pain that Val went through and Wanique. And then I thought, well, what about us? You know, but like, I mean, life is ups and downs, and there's always barriers, there's always, you know, something that you overcome. But when my mom died, that was the most painful thing I've ever experienced. And although it was painful, it really helped us to really realize who we are and what we're going to do for other Aboriginal people out there.
Maybe I can say something too. I was, I might be traumatized for the rest of my life listening to Wanique. And, my new friend right here, I had no idea how people can be so mean, and we're all the same. We all breathe the same air. We walk behind one another's footsteps, and I really feel privileged because I didn't go through any of these, but I know that I can really help others. I really know that I do help a lot of women, and I know that we've left behind a lot of memories that have changed so many people's lives, and we're just two little girls here. I mean, they say that we were really cute.
Any consolation, not consolation, but the first, my mother had found a picture of the first sisters and put it on my wall from as long as I can remember. They showed me how to succeed, and they showed me how to overcome, and they were my role models forever. And that's why it's so important for us to honor our role models, because the only way our kids are going to know how to make their dreams come true is if we show them. And that's the most valuable thing I think I gotten out of my Olympic experience is when I go into a community, and maybe I'm carrying on the work that you guys did, and I see a little girl, especially a little girl, look up at me and go, "You're not that big." They expect you as an Olympian to be this giant superhero, and you're just as big as them, and see that spark go on in their head that they can do it. And maybe just knowing that they can do it will save their life one day, because I know that it saved my life many times over when I was going through hard times. And I cannot tell you how thankful I am that you guys persevered and didn't quit, because you showed me how to do it.
Sport and Society was produced by the University of British Columbia and recorded live at the UBC Chan Center for the Performing Arts. Intellectual Muscle was developed by Vancouver 2010 and the University of British Columbia in collaboration with universities across Canada and the Globe and Mail.